Florida's primary is edging closer, but what role will the Sunshine State play in picking a candidate? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Our primary comes weeks after Super Tuesday, and there's a chance that the eventual Democratic presidential nominee will have already secured enough delegates. We'll learn about the time state officials tried moving the state's primary date higher on the calendar. Also, there's a very popular program that gives loans to people to hurricane-proof and or make their homes more efficient. But there are critics who question whether the program is loaning money to some who can't pay it back. And we'll look at a new exhibit that views South Florida through the eyes of the slaves who escaped bondage on the Underground Railroad. But first, an update on the violence that erupted in Haiti. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. February is meant to be a celebratory time in Haiti and elsewhere throughout the Caribbean and Latin America. The annual Carnival celebration brings tens of thousands of Haitians to the streets of the nation's capital, Port-au-Prince. But on Sunday, the mood was anything but celebratory. Protesters took to the streets, many of them from Haiti's National Police Force, and they exchanged gunfire with the country's National Armed Forces for hours. There is one reported fatality. Joining me now is the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles. Joining me to tell me about what's going on over there. Jackie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. What led to the gunshots and the violence on Sunday?
Well, members of the Haitian National Police have for months been requesting, demanding, protesting in favor of unionization. They want to form a union. It is against the police internal regulations for Haiti's National Police to unionize. And so in the days leading up to Carnival, what we saw that there were a number of protests where there were police officers on the streets. We saw that there were Carnival stands, viewing stands along the parade route. They were burned, not just in the capital, but also in Cape Haitien, which is the second largest city, and other cities around the country that were scheduled to have Carnival. On Sunday, well, let me back up, because against all of this is this backdrop of the debate in terms of whether or not Haiti, a country that is in a deep political and economic crisis, could afford to spend almost $1 million on a street party, on a three-day street party. And so you've got that debate. You have police officers, you know, complaining about their miserable wages, $200 to $250 a month. If they get paid, often they go months without getting paid. They really don't have any health insurance. They have to pay first when they get sick and then seek reimbursements. And then just overall miserable working conditions. So all of this is feeding into this movement to try to unionize. And then we have the protests. And then we learn that five police officers who were part of this union committee were fired. The police inspector general told me that they were not fired because of their organizing efforts, but because of an earlier incident in February where basically his offices were vandalized and officers came in there shooting up, and then outside they destroyed or vandalized state vehicles by tagging them with the union's logo. So we've got all of this chaos that's happening, and we arrive at Carnival Sunday. And at Carnival Sunday, downtown Chamas, where the parade usually takes place, is empty. But we've got protesters gathering on the other end of the Capitol, and then they're starting to come into the Chamas. Now, I've talked to some journalists who were there on the scene. They said that when the protesters, which included off-duty police officers, arrived, they were shooting their guns up in the air. And you also had members of the armed forces that were on a tower that overlooks the Chamas, which is where the presidential palace is also located. And then you had this exchange of gunfire going back and forth.
Yeah, a lot of things to unfold here. Let's start with this one. You talked about how there's this debate about having this big party, considering everything that's happening. But Carnival is huge for Haiti. right? I mean, it's not something that it's very important.
Carnival is huge, but last year Carnival was canceled because of the political unrest, because of the violence. Today, Haiti, there hasn't been much change in Haiti this year compared to last year. And on top, you have a deepening issue with insecurity. We've been told that there is a resurgence in kidnappings that have been happening, kidnappings for ransom. It is not just people of means, but people without means. So all of this is happening, and there was already a question on whether or not Haiti's National Police Force could provide security during a huge event on that, adding to the fact that within the police force, you have officers who are disgruntled and who are demanding, you know, the ability to unionize and asking the government to address their concerns.
Are police working? I mean, are there police working right now, or are they all basically, you know, saying no until you hear our demands? We're not.
No, the police force, which is about 15,000, it's a national police force, they are working. But what was disturbing in all of this, and what I've seen even in November when those who are in favor of a union came out, is that there are these silent sympathizers within the police force. I mean, interesting enough, on Sunday, anti-riot police were sent out to quell the protests, and they did not want to shoot on their colleagues. And in some instances, you saw where they basically were tapping guys on the shoulder as support. I mean, regardless of whether a police officer is in favor or is not in favor of unionization, the reality is that you have a police force today that is financed largely by the United States and Canada, that was trained by the United Nations, and it is on the verge of an implosion because there are real grievances, which even the Haitian government has recognized, that the police demands are just. It's just a question now of whether or not Haiti can even address or meet these requests. During a press conference on Saturday, Haitian President Jovenel Moïse basically says, look, you know, we can't immediately address the issue of the pay raise because of regulations in terms of how much money public servants can get, but we're going to announce some new measures. One of them was they talked about building a police village where police officers on their $200 a month before taxes salary will be able to buy a 2-bedroom apartment payable over 25 to 30 years at a 7.5% interest rate. Another measure is where they will be able to borrow money from a pension fund that is normally closed to public servants that has an interest rate of 12%, but the government says we'll pay 6% and you pay 6%. But in order for that police officer to access any of those loans, they have to buy insurance. The other measure that they did announce was that they would take a card, a debit card, which is really a privilege that they get, and they would double it from $50 a month to $100 a month. I don't know if you see where I'm going. Take home salary is about $130 a month in a country where your inflation rate is over 20%, and it's one for one in terms of the one good versus one U.S. dollar. The cost of living is skyrocketing. 4 million Haitians, according to the United Nations, are going to be in deep food insecurity by next month. And you're telling police officers, we can't give you more money, but we're giving you the ability to get deeper into debt.
Who are the national armed forces that they were fighting with?
So this is the army. Haiti... Former President Aristide had disbanded the army in 1995, and so there's always been this debate about bringing the army back. President Michel Martelly, who was a predecessor to the current President Moïse, issued a decree that brought back the army, but really we saw the army come back under President Jovenel Moïse. And this is his army. These guys were sent to Ecuador to train. We don't really know how many individuals are part of this army, what kind of weapons they have. One thing that we do know is they're really not supported by the United States or Canada, Haiti's main supporters. And so Haiti controls this army as opposed to with the National Police Force. While the president, you know, gets to choose his own police chief, he still runs that choice by the U.S. You know, the international community has a lot of say in terms of the Haitian National Police, but not really any in respect to the army.
What have you been hearing from Haitians on the ground there?
I have to tell you, I mean, when you talk to Haitians, on the ground, it's disturbing. And they're watching the one institution in this country that works on the verge of implosion. You know, I've had people say to me, you know, you get stopped by a police officer. I'm not sure if this is a cop that was out in the street shooting his gun up on Sunday, or if this is a police officer who's there to really give me security. They recognize the frustrations of the police, but they do not condone the violence. When you start having the police acting like the bandits on the streets that they are supposed to be going after. And at the same time, the police itself is recognizing that those who are in favor of union, that there's been infiltration, you know, so because we also saw instances where there were gang leaders now coming out of the slums on Sunday, people with opening brandishing guns. And so people who were on that scene on the Shamas on Sunday, it was hard to tell who was a cop, who wasn't a cop, off duty or not.
And you said kidnappings were up. I mean, so who's supposed to handle that? The police or the military?
The police. So the military, President Jovenel Moïse says that the military is there to deal with disaster issues and not to get involved in domestic affairs. The military, after the shooting, which they said lasted for more than 6 hours, and they said it was when hooded individuals fired on the tower, which is located in their headquarters, they are saying that there was no confrontation between the army, you know, and the police. Other people will disagree. But clearly we have arrived at a point in Haiti today where the two armed forces in this country were engaged in a firefight. And yesterday, the high command of the army even issued a statement where it was lecturing the Haitian National Police on how it should carry itself and, you know, and what their responsibilities are. I mean, there is clearly tension there. And there's a question to be asked is whether or not Haiti, which has not completely provided the budget it needs to provide to the police, whether it's siphoning resources that should go to the police and giving it now to the army.
I mean, you talk about what the government's willing to offer police, but what do you think is next? What happens now?
Well, the police union organizing committee, which includes the five individuals who were fired last week, they have basically issued five things that they want. Number one, they're saying in order for the protest movement to die down or at least not to take place, they're asking for the immediate reinstatement of those five police officers who were fired. At the same time, they want recognition of this union. As I mentioned, it's against the internal regulations of the Haitian National Police to unionize. And their argument is that the Constitution of Haiti allows organizing, and they want immediate recognition. They also want a committee to be established with a human rights observer group involved, and they want a commitment from what is called the CSPN, which is the police chief, the prime minister, that they're not going to try and block this effort for them to form a union.
Again, been talking with Jacqueline Charles, the Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald, reporting on the violent gun battles in Haiti during Carnival, one of the biggest celebrations of the year. You can follow her stories on our social media, WLRN Sundial. It's an amazing story. Jacqueline, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, still to come, Florida's primaries come after Super Tuesday, but it wasn't always that way. We're going to get a little history lesson from Dr. Susan McManus coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Democratic presidential candidates are in South Carolina tonight for another debate ahead of this Saturday's primary voting. It comes after another victory for Bernie Sanders' campaign in Nevada. But the Democratic presidential nominee is far from confirmed, with a number of key states voting next week on Super Tuesday. Now, Florida's primary isn't until March 17th. More than a decade ago, Florida tried to move its primary voting day up into January, but the state's delegates were penalized. With more of that history and analysis of this year's presidential election in Florida, we're joined now by Dr. Susan McManus. She's a University of South Florida Distinguished University Professor Emerita and Political Analyst. Dr. McManus, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You know, as we enter our fourth state now in this primary season and we're getting closer to Super Tuesday, Do you think Florida can still be relevant in the primary, considering we're in middle March?
I absolutely do. There's much made about Bernie Sanders being so far ahead of everyone else, but if you simply go to the amount of delegates or the number of delegates that have been pledged, they're spread all over the place. And so I don't think that we're going to know who's going to be nominated or reach the 1,990 pledged delegates point by the time we get to Florida. And in fact, I think that some of these people who maybe are not catching fire as much, but they're hanging on and they're still accumulating delegates, that there is some motive for them to hang on and see if they can leverage their positions and policies if it goes to a brokered convention.
And if that's the case, and we have a handful of candidates here in Florida for the March 17th primary, what do you think they need to do to win this state? Because even more than Nevada, this is a very diverse state.
They have got to come here and be seen in very key parts of this state. If you want to look at one of the reasons that Trump has done well in terms of increasing his support here in Florida, he's still not a majority, but he's done it by holding huge rallies. Of course, that's a style that's not really as amenable to multiple candidates. But what we do know is that this is an election where people want to be appealed to directly. And if they can see a candidate in person or in their town, the chances that they're going to vote go up and that they'll vote for that person go up. So there's a lot of places for them to visit, and it's not too late either. As you know, many people who have asked for a vote by mail ballot, Democrats, are kind of holding on to them and not turning them in until they see what proceeds ahead of us and where their impact might matter most. But it is true that by the time that Super Tuesday's over, they estimate that just 40% or so of the pledged delegates will have been selected, and it will be only 70% by the time it gets here. So if they're spread out all over the place, you can bet Florida's going to be front and center. Not only because this is a state that has 29 electoral college votes, the third most, it's also a state where Florida Democrats give a lot of money to campaigns, so they're looking at that for the general election.
Yeah, it's interesting. You think about some of the history. So we're March 17th, but it was 2008. Florida wanted to move their primary earlier because they wanted to be more important. Now, problem is, a lot of states were trying to move, their primaries up. What happened?
They were penalized for jumping the gun because, as you know, the set pattern is that you have Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. Those states go first, but especially always New Hampshire, Iowa, and New Hampshire. So when Florida went first and defied it, we lost delegates at the national convention. And some say that Hillary Clinton she did win the primary when the Democrats went early, but she ended up losing Florida delegates because they couldn't pledge to her. And so some say that was one of the reasons that she lost in that particular election cycle.
I heard it again this year. I've heard it every election, why we start with Iowa and New Hampshire. Florida's so big. It's so important. Why aren't we earlier? Do you think that the schedule stays the same, or will it ever change?
I believe it's going to change after this cycle. For one thing, if you look at the candidates that are running, that initially, and I was blessed to attend as an analyst, the debates down in Miami where there are 20-some candidates, and now it's, of course, winnowed down. But one of the complaints is that you have to spend so much money in little Iowa, which is a very small number of pledged delegates, that then when it comes to like a big Super Tuesday with 14 states, a lot of these candidates are cash starved because television and so forth is very expensive when you're running in California, New York, and Texas, just to mention, and those are three states that go on Super Tuesday. I also agree with many analysts who pointed out that if Bernie Sanders does not secure the nomination, that would be another reason that they would discount the caucus and the New Hampshire primary. But I think it's a matter of money. Two small states that have a very small number of delegates, and yet it can winnow out the money, winnow out candidates just because of money that's spent there. That's a pretty big reason to argue that it might change.
All right. Now, folks who've lived here long enough know Florida is a closed primary state. Folks who are new to the state are learning this as they get ready for the primary. Remind us of the difference between the open and closed primary again.
We have had the closed primary since 1913. I think only around 10 or 11 states still have it. In a closed primary, you have to be registered with that party to vote in that party's primary. So if you are a Democrat, you want to be a Democrat and you want to vote in that primary, you must be registered with that party. And the same on the Republican side. Only Republicans can vote in the Republican primary. And the argument for it, going back time eternal, is that it allows the parties which have very different platforms and perspectives to select their own candidate who's going to be carrying that party's label or banner into the general election. In open primary, there are two kinds. There's one that's being proposed for Florida, and if the Supreme Court gives the go-ahead, it will be voted on as an amendment this year, but not take effect till 2024. It's called a top two or a jungle primary. And if we had that, every candidate that was running for governor, for example, Democrat, Republican, whomever, Libertarians, Reform Party, every candidate, and there could be multiple from the same party, put their name on the list, and then the voters pick one, and then the top two vote getters go in a runoff in the general election.
That changes everything.
Only four states have that. The other type of open primary is more common, where it lets the NPAs or no party affiliation on election day or in that primary say, okay, I'm more interested in voting in the Democratic primary, so they could do that. Or if I'm more interested in voting in the Republican primary, I can do that. So the two primaries, two party primaries, are still sustained, whereas technically the top two is really not a primary system at all. It kind of gets rid of it.
I'm talking with Dr. Susan McManus, Professor Emerita at the University of South Florida. Florida's primaries are in just a few weeks. We are discussing a little bit of the history of our primary and why it's a closed system, as you just heard. Again, it's coming up on March 17th. The deadline to register for that already has passed. Dr. McManus, you know, Florida, again, will be one of those key states in the general election. But, you know, we saw it in 2018. There were three races that had to go, state races that had to go to, a recount. Do you think that Florida is going to be that tight of a state from this point forward, moving forward?
Well, you know, for 4 years, four elections prior to 2018, that would have been two presidential and two gubernatorial. The margin of victory for the winner was only 1%. But 2018, it became 0.5%. So there are a lot of people who now describe us as the most competitive state in the entire country, and not no longer just the 1% state, but the 0.5%. And in just looking at registration drives that are underway by both parties at the moment, it's looking very much like we will have a nail biter again in this state in November.
But, you know, the state keeps changing because of the demographics, again, keep changing.
Yes.
You think about one thing, for example, a big group that's come into the state over the last few years are Puerto Ricans because of the hurricanes and the earthquakes. How may that change anything in the election, especially in the I-4 corridor?
Obviously, both parties are really aggressively going after the Puerto Rican vote, because it is true historically that people coming from the island don't come with strong party affiliations as we know them here. They're more statehood or not statehood, not Democrat or Republican. But obviously, Democrats are heavily going after the new arrivals because they obviously can vote immediately. But they're using the issue of the delayed federal aid to Puerto Rico after all the disasters. On the other hand, the Republicans are using more issues related to jobs and the economy and, you know, somewhat religious freedom. So you see each party going after them differently, even though it is true from what we could observe in 2018 that the Puerto Rican vote is leaning more towards Democrats.
And when you look at South Florida, what role do you think it's going to play in this primary coming up?
Huge, because a heavy concentration of all of Florida's Democrats live from Central Florida down. Percentage-wise, you have in the counties in South Florida, Miami-Dade, Palm Beach, Broward, those have a huge percentage of voters, and obviously the number one media market for, in terms of percentage, where Democrats in Florida live, the number one market is Miami-Dade, or the Miami market, followed by Orlando and Tampa. So those are the top three media markets, which contain together well over half of all the registered voters in Florida, registered Democrats.
Let me finish with this. I mean, in 2018, we had, again, some issues, you know, in Palm Beach County and Broward County at the supervisor of elections offices. And, of course, there was, you know, there were reports of hacking, Russian hacking, on two districts. Though we don't know which ones they are, we could speculate. But what do you think, how is that going to all play out in November? Do we have to worry, or can we be confident we could pull this off?
I've looked at a lot of polling on that, and the, all of the, you know, training sessions and whatever that are going on, not only in Florida, but across the country, cybersecurity threats and so forth. The problem is that we don't think it will happen, but trying to deflect it, if you look at it this way, corporate America hasn't been able to solve the problem. Neither has the U.S. government and everything, all of its security. But the state of Florida has really aggressively, with some federal monies, been on the forefront of trying to stymie any kind of cybersecurity threats. The comforting thing is that in a poll that was taken not long ago, a national poll, but probably reflects Florida, when people were asked what was their number one concern about election integrity and so forth, the intrusion by foreign nations was not near the top. At the top was being subjected to misinformation or false information. So people were really worried very much about that.
We'll take that comfort if we can get it. Hopefully all things run smoothly. Dr. Susan McManus, again, University of South Florida, Distinguished University Professor Emerita and Political Analyst. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Well, on Saturday, we are going to be carrying NPR special coverage of the South Carolina primaries. It starts at 5 o'clock. You can find more details at WLRN.org. All right, if you're looking to add solar panels to your home and get energy-efficient lighting, it could be kind of expensive up front. Florida's PACE program was created as one potential solution. The Property Assessed Clean Energy Program provides tens of thousands of dollars in loans with no down payment or credit check needed. A new study from the University of Southern Florida found that the program has been extremely popular over the last 5 years, and Miami-Dade is the largest market for it. But lawmakers have raised concerns about lending practices. The Miami Herald's Alex Harris joins us now. She's been following the story. Alex, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
All right. For those unfamiliar, PACE, P-A-C-E, the program, how does it work exactly? Because it's about energy efficiency, but also things like hurricane shutters as well.
Right. So the Property Assessed Clean Energy Program was created as an alternative for people who wanted to ready their home for hurricanes or install clean energy, in this case, mostly solar panels, but didn't have the cash for it. So it's a program that allows you to get a new hurricane-proof roof, windows, doors, a brand new air conditioning system that's very efficient, or solar panels or other alternative energy. And it doesn't require a credit check. It doesn't require you to make a down payment. It's an alternative to a traditional loan product from a bank because it draws from your property taxes.
Is this similar to the one or the same one that was started in California that's very popular?
It is the same program. It was pioneered at the same time in California and Florida, but it took off first in California and is now kind of surging in Florida.
How successful has it been? I mean, I mentioned just a little bit at the top here, but I mean, how popular is it here in Florida?
So the University of South Florida study that I wrote about talked about Y Green Energy, which is one of the companies, but it's the biggest company. It controls about 80% of the market share in Florida. And according to this study, Y Green alone, and kind of therefore Pace, has almost doubled the amount of contracts it signed in the last 16 months compared to the last 5 years. So from 2013 to 2018, about $400 million worth of contracts. And in the last 16 months of August to 2018 and November to 2019, another $342 million.
We want to point out, because you did as well as in your story, that USF did get funding from Y Green for the study, right?
Right. So this is a study funded by Y Green, focused on Y Green, and using a formula that Y Green came up with to determine their economic and environmental impact.
Are there other programs like PACE in other states? Is this, or how unique is this?
PACE is pretty much the biggest of the program. There are some similar sort of styled programs in St. Lucie County in Florida. There's SELF, which is kind of different but similar from PACE and allows basically individual loans to property owners who are looking to do these kinds of improvements. But PACE really runs the market. It's kind of one of a kind compared to a loan from a bank or, you know, getting federal funding from FEMA or something like that.
So this is supposed to be this great program, helps homeowners, no credit check, you know, no down payment, low interest for these loans so you can make these adjustments on your house. Lawmakers, though, have some issues with lending practices. What problems do they have with PACE?
So PACE exploded first in California, and then came the stories of vulnerable, low-income, minority communities that were targeted, they said, by contractors who were scamming them, who were unfair practices, who were targeting people who weren't aware of how much this program would cost. They talked to them and said, you know, this is something you don't have to pay for, something you don't have to put a credit check for, down payment for, I mean. And when their property taxes went up tremendously at the end of the year, some people were stuck underwater financially. And because PACE, it puts a property tax lien on your home, and it is the first tax lien, it goes over your mortgage. If you don't pay these newly higher taxes, you can lose your home. And California, in response, put together a lot of consumer protections. No more kickbacks to contractors. You have to spell out all the issues first. There's a 3-day waiting period. All of these consumer protections that have reduced the amount of complaints about the program. Florida, however, has none baked into the state level. Different communities have set up their own, but it's still kind of patchwork and doesn't have the same sort of level of protection that California has.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's climate change reporter, Alex Harris. She recently wrote about Florida's PACE energy program, how it's changing the renewable energy landscape in our state while raising concerns, though, about lending practices. You could find more details in her story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. As mentioned, Miami-Dade is the biggest market for PACE. How have leaders here in this community addressed those concerns, or are they?
So Miami-Dade allowed PACE to come as part of an agreement. It runs the Green Corridor up and down South Florida. Y Green runs that, which kind of allows all of these contracts to be signed. In Miami-Dade so far, there hasn't been a ton of conversation about it. Miami-Dade County Commissioner Dennis Moss put together some legislation to sort of come up with a document that both sides would sign that spell out the risks and pluses and financial costs associated with this program, but that was tabled and never went very far.
Because, I mean, you pointed out, for example, across the state in Collier County, they got a little bit tighter on this.
Collier County kicked the residential program out of the county altogether because of what they call a pattern of targeting from contractors to vulnerable communities. They still run the commercial side of things, which has far fewer complaints across the state and in California as well, but the residential side is where the complaints are concentrated, and Collier still hasn't enacted it back again.
Lawmakers in Tallahassee talking about this?
Some of them are. So there were a couple bills in session happening right now that would seek to reform the program. Some from South Florida, some from North Florida, but as far as I can tell, they haven't budged in committee since they were introduced in December.
How many homeowners have you found who've ended up in that situation, like you had mentioned, who all of a sudden they find themselves underwater? They find themselves, they're behind.
So the Miami Herald has written about a couple elderly Haitian families before in the past. This is not a new story. Pace has been around since 2013. These complaints have been coming in. So we have a couple that we've written about. There are a bunch of stories in Tampa. There are stories from Broward and Collier. Pretty much most counties where this is operating, you can find homeowners who have been affected by this and have been written about by their local journalists who have experienced poor financial handling from these contractors.
Have you gotten any questions from readers about how this is supposed to work?
Yes, I've gotten a couple calls and emails from readers, and if anyone else wants to reach out, feel free. I'm collecting stories about Y-Green and Pace. If you had a good experience, please let me know. If you've had a bad experience, please let me know. I've gotten a couple emails from readers after this story saying that, you know, the program works great for them. I've had other ones say, this program did not work out great for me, and I chose not to use it, or I'm paying more than I think I should be paying. It seems like there's a variety of experience from what I've heard from my readers so far.
What are the representatives from Pace saying, though, about the complaints and about, again, these concerns?
Right. So I talked to Mike Lemire, who's with Y-Green Energy, in depth for this story. And they point out that while the state-level consumer protections may not be here in Florida, that they themselves have made a lot of changes to be more transparent. They have a hotline that Y-Green consumers can call if they have any questions. There is that state-mandated three-day waiting period between signing the contract and being locked into it, and they try to reach out to all of their customers during that period and answer any questions they may have. In Miami-Dade, you can get the contracts in Haitian Creole, in Spanish, or in English, depending on which language you speak, which is not the same everywhere. And some other consumer protections that they argue they're doing a great job at. And they also note that their interest rates, they say, are lower than you would get through a traditional consumer bank loan.
So it seems like as attractive as that, you know, no interest, no background check or no credit checks, you know, there's still a lot of questions homeowners should be asking. You got to know where this could end up later.
Right. As long as you are prepared for those higher property tax hikes and you are financially ready for it, it doesn't seem to be much of a problem. The problem seems to come if you are unaware or unprepared.
And again, we'll share her information, Alex's information, because again, if you're one of those homeowners and you've got a story to share, we'll let you guys connect. Again, talking with the Miami Herald's climate change reporter, Alex Harris. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
All right. Still to come, a new photo exhibit gives us the perspective of an escaped slave using the Underground Railroad down to South Florida. That's coming up. In the history that my people passed over to me, where is deity in a memory that I carry from when I was young? Here is my home in Miami, where they said that giving someone. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. And those are some of the sounds that you will hear as you walk through the new photo exhibition, The Four Moments of the Sun, Hidden Lands of Florida's Maroon Communities. It tells the story of how runaway slaves ended up in South Florida. Now, during the 18th and 19th century, slaves escaped into the Florida wilderness of the Everglades, and they established a home there. Photographer Janine McNabales is sharing this history, and she's an artist in residence in Everglades, and she joins me now. Janine, it's such a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, I just want to mention that you could see some of her photos on our social media at WLRN Sundial. They are truly amazing. Janine, you published this series of photographs, again, called Through Darkness to Light, Photographs Along the Underground Railroad. These are photographs, a lot of them, they're dark. They're taken at night or they're in that twilight period that would depict maybe life as through the eyes of a slave running and navigating through the woods, through communities, through the Underground Railroad. What inspired you to tell this story?
Goodness. That whole project, Through Darkness to Light, took 14 years. I grew up kind of between Indiana and Florida. I had divorced parents, so lived with my mom in Florida, but would visit my father often down in Florida. And so I guess part of the curriculum growing up in our grade schools was the Underground Railroad. And so I just remember being fascinated with it at an early age and just trying to imagine what that view would have looked like. So in the early 2000s, I started researching that and looking into different ways that I guess African Americans were escaping slavery. And one route was through the Underground Railroad. And then I found other routes going into, you know, Spanish Texas or Spanish Florida. So just became fascinated with what that would look like. And I definitely chose a first person viewpoint on purpose because I wanted to make sure that there was no doubt that it was the freedom seeker that had the wherewithal to make this decision, and a life-changing decision for that matter, to seek freedom.
You know, knowing the context of the project and looking at these photos, it makes you uneasy because you almost feel like you're looking, you're waiting to see if the coast is clear, then nobody is there, nobody's watching you. You get to travel through so many parts of the South. Was it hard finding, you know, the landscapes that still hold the similar view and feel that they did 160 years ago?
Definitely. A lot of the buildings and structures have either been altered, renovated, if you will. Like one of the barns that I originally photographed, they went ahead and put vinyl siding on it, and so it didn't look like an 1800s barn anymore. Or, you know, they were damaged beyond repair and had left to rot, so they didn't look the same. So it was a bunch of obstacles to overcome and to piece them together. And so with the new series, The Four Moments of the Sun, and those Florida Maroon communities, it was very much a challenge because there absolutely is nothing left of these communities anymore. They did discover some artifacts on several of the properties, and those are held in some collections. But for the most part, there are no structures. So it was definitely a different challenge to try to photograph this particular series.
I remember from history classes, the Underground Railroad, Harriet Tubman, and again, slaves trying to escape. But most of what I remember was they were trying to escape to the north. You find in your research that the Underground Railroad also had slaves coming deep down into South Florida. Why were they coming here?
Well, that is, I'm just going to specify quickly that historians will bristle if we say Underground Railroad applying to this Southern migration, because it was pre-Underground Railroad. So it was before that terminology was even in existence. So this is, we're looking at mid to late 1700s and early 1800s. And the very first community was in, it was entitled Fort Moses in St. Augustine. And that was in the mid-late 1700s. And if we go back to our Florida history, Florida changed hands multiple times. So it was held by the Spanish in the first Spanish period, then it switched to the British, then it switched back to the Spanish for the second Spanish period, and then ultimately came to the Americans. And so the allegiances for these communities changed during those transitions of government.
Go ahead. No, please continue.
So the Spanish government actually offered freedom to escaping slaves that came down into Spanish Florida if they agreed to convert to Roman Catholicism. And so that was one of the reasons why they were headed down to St. Augustine. And I did find some, personal correspondence and letters and such that spoke about slaves actually adamantly discussing going down to St. Augustine to escape. And that was kind of, I guess, one of the discussions they had before the Stono Rebellion in the Carolinas.
I'm talking with Janine McNabale. She's a Dallas-based photographer and an artist in residence in the Everglades. Her exhibition, The Four Moments of the Sun, Hidden Lands of Florida's Maroon Communities, tells the history of former slaves who established their own societies, their own communities in the wilderness of the Everglades, again in the 18th and 19th century. Now, this is on display at the Airy Nest Gallery and Everglades National Park until August 30th. And as I mentioned, we have some of those photos up on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I wanted to get to one of the images, the largest image you have in the gallery. It's entitled Mirrored Worlds. This was taken in the Big Cypress Preserve. This is a gorgeous photograph of water. And so I can see the rocks beneath the water, but I can see the reflection of the tree line in the water overimposed on top of that. But tell me a little bit about this photo and, again, part of the story that you're telling.
Yeah, so basically, kind of the way I came upon the inspiration for the title of the series is I had found when I was at Fort Mose in St. Augustine, they had a Congo cosmogram up, and I was unsure what that was. So if you actually imagine a plus sign or a cross that has a longer horizontal line on it, with each point ending in a circle with an oval, overall oval around it. And initiates read the cosmogram by imagining God at the top, the dead at the bottom, and water in between. And the horizontal lines divided the mountain of the living world from the kingdom of the dead. And the four discs at each point of the cross symbolize the four moments of the sun, which yields the title. So it's dawn for birth, noon for the height of your life, dusk for winding down, and then midnight is when you're at the height of your, I guess, afterworld, afterlife. And then they believe in reincarnation and coming back to life. And so the title of that image is actually talking back to that Congo cosmogram and the mirrored worlds of the living and the dead and reincarnation.
How did these communities come to be known as Maroon communities?
It's interesting. It's coming from, there are about four or five different interpretations, but the one that I seem to have heard the most is that it's coming from the Spanish word cimarron. And that Spanish word had kind of a slang context to it that meant wild or unruly or runaway. And so that's kind of where that came into, is a Cimarron community, or then shortened in English to Maroon community.
How do you hope that this history that you've uncovered will shape the dialogue around Black history in general, in South Florida especially?
I think the hardest challenge that I had and am having in producing and trying to finish this project is communicating the juxtaposition of these very real historical communities and what they represent. On the one hand, you have the United States and its misguided view of manifest destiny and the right to take property that does not belong to it, including First Peoples lands, and as well as viewing human beings as property. And then on the other hand, you have Indigenous and African Americans trying to isolate themselves and live peacefully away from the reach of the Southern plantation economy. In the eyes of the United States government, the two could not, and therefore would not, coexist. And so literally, Andrew Jackson and the United States forces systematically wiped out these communities. So they would go in and annihilate a community, and then there would be some people that would be able to escape and make their way south, and then they would go and live in that community for a while and then continue making their way further south. So eventually, that's when some of them did end up in the Florida Everglades. And there was a group that made it all the way across the Florida Everglades to what we know as Key Biscayne today, but they called it Cape Florida back then.
Yeah.
And then they were taken by indigenous canoes to Key West, and then British wreckers picked them up and took them to the Bahamas, and that's where a group of descendants still live today.
In your 14 years of researching this, putting this project together, what was the most surprising thing that you learned about these freedom seekers?
Oh, goodness. I have the utmost respect for the process that they went through when they had no idea whether or not they would succeed. And if they didn't succeed, most likely they would be killed or they would be tortured beyond recognition as an example for others that would consider fleeing. So, again, that's why I said that I chose that first person perspective, because I feel like there is no other way that you could tell the story without giving them their due course for what they went through.
This is an amazing collection of photographs. Again, speaking with photographer and ARRI fellow Janine McNabales, her exhibition, The Four Moments of the Sun, Hidden Lands of Florida's Maroon Communities. It's on display at the Ernest F. Coe Visitor Center in Everglades National Park. And you can hear her talk, by the way, about the exhibition. She's got a speech coming up on March 1st. Janine, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And again, if you want to see some of those photos, we've got them up on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, February 25th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, more than half of Florida students took AP tests last year. That's the highest percentage in the nation, but nearly half of those students failed their AP exams. And you may have seen comedian Ida Rodriguez's new special on Netflix. The homestead-born and bred performer is back home with a couple of shows this week. She joins us to discuss her career and her desire to tackle difficult issues in comedy. And by the way, you've been listening to singer, where you're listening to singer-songwriter Inez Barlatier all throughout the program. She was one of our Live from the 305 performers last year. She'll be in Fort Lauderdale for their Story Slam March 7th. Again, don't forget, by the way, that we have our book club. Find us on Facebook at Sundial Book Club on Facebook. You can ask to join. It's free. We're going to be announcing our March book coming up on Thursday. We have a special conversation coming up on Thursday as well. One of the characters from this month's book, Cattail, is going to be our special guest. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. Tout le monde joue.